So, as you can see, guys, we're in Acts chapter 7, Stephen's history lesson. This is going to be a fun chapter. In Acts chapter 6, verse 11, we see people coming to accuse Stephen. We can probably turn that down a little bit, too. That's actually cranking, isn't it? That's good. Let's get some good volume. You guys good? Awesome. Thanks, Randy. So, in Acts chapter 6, verse 11, we've seen these people coming to accuse Stephen of speaking against Moses and against God. And then again, at the end of chapter 6 and verse 13 and 14, we see these false witnesses now that are being brought together by the Sanhedrin. They're being brought to, again, once more, accuse Stephen of saying that he spoke against the temple and their law. The very similar stuff that we saw happening with Jesus as people were rejecting Jesus and looking to see him crucified. They're bringing these false accusations against him. So now, Stephen, what he does here in chapter 7 is he sets out to give a broad run-through now of Israel's history. And in doing so, he wasn't trying to educate the Sanhedrin of their past. I mean, the Sanhedrin were people that no doubt knew their history, but maybe there were things that they were overlooking, things that they needed to be reminded of, things that maybe they had not really thought through properly. Primarily, Stephen was simply laying out the truth that was found within their own scriptures. And he's building a great case. And Stephen's not sitting here trying to just defend himself to say, wait a second, guys. But what he's doing is he's just laying out the truth now for these people right from their own scriptures, truth that they probably hadn't really seen in that light before. And so what Stephen is seeking to do now is to show them, give them examples from their past of times where their own fathers, their own people have rejected those that God has sent. Because that's what's happening right here as Stephen and the other apostles are looking to promote Jesus, teach on Jesus. They're just shutting this down. They're saying, we want nothing to do with Jesus. Wait a second. And he came and he was crucified. Surely he's not the Son of God. If he hung on a cross, that can't be God. No way. They rejected the one that God sent. And Stephen is looking to build this case, just to lay out the truth now for them of the very things that they were doing here. Now, look at verse 1. And again, this kind of brings us into context here now and flows from chapter 6. The high priest now said, are these things so? All these things that are being brought against you, Stephen, the high priest is simply saying, give us your plea. Guilty or not guilty? So he's standing before a court, in a sense, here with the Sanhedrin, this 71-member ruling, governing body, this council that was known as the Sanhedrin, made up of elders, Pharisees, Sadducees. And the high priest was kind of like the leading figure of the 71-member Sanhedrin. So we ask that question, are these things so? What do you have to say about this, Stephen? People are saying that he's telling others that Jesus is going to destroy the temple and then he's going to change the customs of Moses that was given to them. And remember, like I said, they brought in these false witnesses to say all these untrue things about Stephen. Yet in all that stuff, what does it say at the end of chapter 6? That Stephen just sat there with his face like that of an angel. He's not in turmoil over these false accusations. He's in perfect peace with the Lord, right? False accusations coming, and he's just glowing, right? Face of an angel. I think that probably would have been said about me too. Face of an angel. Maybe a fallen angel. I would have been like bitter. I would have been like, what are you talking about, man? You know, get out of here. I would have been the one gnashing my teeth, not them, right? But I mean, here's Stephen, face of an angel, just glowing. And it's really interesting because he's going to bring them through this great history now. And here he was being charged that he was trying to destroy the things of Moses. Yet he's standing very similar to Moses. Remember, Moses brought the law down. His face was glowing. Here's Stephen now, standing in the same kind of way as Moses. He wasn't against Moses. He was quite like Moses, glowing face and all. So in chapter 7 here, we're going to look at this long discourse being given by Stephen. Again, not so much to defend himself. He's got nothing to prove. He's just laying out the truth. I think that's wonderful, too. Think about this. Stephen's not trying to, you know, save his bacon here. He's not trying to say what's going to appease the Sanhedrin to get him out. He's just saying, I'm going to lay out the truth for you guys. Whatever that does to me, so be it. I'd rather stand by the truth than be, you know, kind of let go and freed by a lie. And so Stephen just simply says, I'm going to give it everything. And he's going to give this case of Israel's long history, not just a history lesson, but a history of Israel's rebellion and stubbornness, to show that the way that these leaders are acting today is no different than what we've seen all through their history. And to build a case, basically, that God is not subject just to working there in the temple or working just in Israel, but all through the history, God was not subject just to certain places and a certain people, but he worked along all these things. And so, look at verse 2. And he said, Stephen now begins this great sermon. And he said, brethren and fathers, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran, and said to him, get out of your country and from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you. Stephen shows now that God appeared to Abraham, again, outside of the temple, even outside of the land of Israel. Abraham's hanging out in Mesopotamia. This is where he's grown up, in a land just with a pagan people, a pagan country, full of idolaters and all. And there's Abraham growing up in this. And God, just by his grace, goes and he selects this man for a special task, a special role in God's economy here. But he's not a Jew. He's not a Hebrew. They haven't had those people yet, right? He just selects him out of Mesopotamia, calls him out even while he was in a heathen land. And God called Abraham, I love this too, this pilgrim's life, to be a sojourner. Abraham, get out of your country, leave your family, and just let's get on the move here, okay, Abraham? We're going to move. And notice there, God says, come to a land that I will show you. Don't you love that? Abraham didn't sit back and go, wait, God, where do you want me to go? What's this place like? Are we there yet? He's not asking all these questions, right? He's just told to go. And Abraham is either going to respond in obedience or not. You can either sit back and go, well, I want to see all this figured out. I mean, aren't we like that oftentimes? We want to see the whole puzzle fit together, how everything is going to work, how everything's going to fit together. When God says, here's what I want you to do. Well, okay, Lord, great, but I'm going to just hold back now. I'm going to be a little bit slow until I see how that's all going to fit together. But God doesn't do that. God calls and he wants us to begin to step out in faith and just to respond in obedience. And here's the thing. Abraham begins to go. And as Abraham begins to go, then God begins to arrange the puzzle pieces. Then he begins to put the next piece into play. And he begins to show a little bit more of the picture. God's not going to be quick just to unravel it all for us, because then it voids us from walking in faith, how God wants us to be. So God simply says, come to a land that I will show you. I'm not going to show you yet, Abraham. I'm not going to reveal everything to you right now. That'd be too easy. No. Just step out in faith. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be an adventure. And that's what God is calling Abraham to do, to live that life of faith, to live that adventurous life of just trusting the Lord, and to be a pilgrim. Don't begin to put down roots. Don't begin to just hang out in one place. Be a sojourner, right? This is what Abraham and many of Israel's forefathers were called to do, right? It's what we are called to be. We're called to be sojourners, pilgrims in this world. We're not to begin to put down heavy stakes in this ground. We're to live with loose roots in this world where we can get up and go as God calls and directs. Such a blessed way to live, because there's less disruptions when we are living that way, isn't there? When we're living without heavy stakes in the ground. Because, man, when I plant myself, right? It's like, man, when you get home from a busy day of work. There's nothing wrong with this, but here's an example. You get home from a busy day of work, right? And you maybe go to the fridge, you get a nice bowl of ice cream, and you sit down on the couch and you got a blanket over you, right? And you just want to veg out for a little bit. You turn on the TV, you know, something like that. And you just sit down, you veg out. And all of a sudden, you know, you got a child saying, hey, Dad, can you curse? I want to show you something. Dad, can you curse? You're just like, what? I just sat down. I don't want to get up right now. You don't want to be disturbed, right? You're comfortable. You got your bowl of ice cream, your blanket on. You're like, I don't want to wreck this moment, you know? And it's like that with God sometimes, where he says, I don't want you to put down heavy stakes to where you're going to be bothered. You're going to be rocked when it's time to move on. Be living with loose roots in this world and ready just to follow the Lord where he says and where he calls. And this is what Abraham is called to do. Go. Get out of your country from your relatives. Lord, wait a second. It's all I've known. All my familiarity, my comfort is here. What do you mean, get out of my country? This is my home. No, we're going to move, Abraham. We're going to go. And it's going to be, and here's the great thing, guys. When we follow the Lord with loose roots in this world, just saying, God, what you have for me, I'm going to follow. And it just becomes a joyous life. It becomes a thrill ride, doesn't it? We're just like going, man, you know, people can come up to you and you're just on the move and you're like, what are you doing? I don't know, man, but God's called me. I'm just going for it, man. I don't know. Well, how you know when you get there? I have no idea, man. I'm just going to keep going until the Lord directs me this way or that way or says stop here. Okay, now move on. I don't know what's happening, but I'm just following God. He says to go and I'm going. That's a thrill ride. We don't have to have everything figured out. And because of that, we're able to be flexible and just move as God calls and leads. And it's like that with these forefathers of Israel. Abraham was like that. These guys that God calls and they're just to move forward. So, again, come to land that I will show you. And when we begin to step out in faith, God begins to show the next piece of the puzzle. He begins to put the next thing into play and reveal to us bit by bit what he's got in store. It's an exhilarating, exciting life of faith as we follow God. I pray that we're doing that. We're just surrendering everything to the Lord and saying, God, just lead me. I'm ready to follow. And then in verse 4 here, then he came out, Abraham, came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell. And God gave him no inheritance in it, not even enough to set his foot on. But even when Abraham had no child, he promised to give it to him for a possession and to his descendants after him. Abraham leaves Mesopotamia. He comes to Haran, and then he stops, right? And he dwelt there for a time. And this period in his life where he stopped in Haran is going to be wasted, unfruitful years in his life. Because that was not the place that God had for him. God didn't say, hey, Abraham, let's take a little bit of a pit stop. Let's take a bit of a break and run. God never instructed him to do that, but Abraham chose to do so. It was a time where Abraham was walking in partial obedience. He was on the go from where he was from, but took a bit of a break. Partial obedience here. You see, remember, Abraham was told to leave the country of Mesopotamia and to leave his relatives, his family behind. Yet what do we see here? In verse 4, that when his father was dead, Abraham took his father with him. And we also know that he took his nephew Lot with him. Abraham, again, following part of the plan, but not the full plan, not full obedience. And you see, Lot's going to end up being a real kind of burden, a bit of a nuisance to Abraham. He's going to kind of hold him back a bit in some ways. And when we choose to hold on to things that are outside of God's plan or God's will for our lives, it's going to become a burden for us. It's going to be that which is going to potentially hold us back from the fullness of what God has for us. Abraham held on to things that he wasn't supposed to. And we can be a lot like that, where God says, okay, here's what I have for you, but we kind of hold on to some of those things that maybe are a comfort to us. Oh, I can't leave my dad. No way, man. I got to bring him with me. It's a comfort. And in our lives, too, there are things that we might find comfort in, but it's not of the Lord. It's not what God has for us. And God said, I want you to leave those things, let go of them. We might choose to kind of hold on to them for a bit of sake. Oh, God, no way to say, it's just, I'm not really, you know, using this law, just sort of there if maybe I need it. But it's going to be that which is going to hold us back from what God has for us. Now, with Abraham here, it didn't mean that the promise was nullified now that he had done this, but it was certainly put on hold. Certainly Abraham wasn't going to really experience the fullness of God, the leading of God in the same way until some of these things were taken care of. But once Abraham continued on into the land of Israel, then God was really going to bless him. And so we see in verse 4, he moved into this land in which he now dwell in Israel, and God gave him no inheritance. Understand that the blessing for Abraham was not about property. Abraham wasn't given any part of the land. Not even one area that you set your foot on, it's not going to be yours. There's going to be no inheritance for you, Abraham. His reward or promise was not about property, but more so about posterity. That God was going to bless him through giving him a family. And from his seed, all the nations would be blessed. There'd be a great posterity from Abraham. And basically, when Abraham heard that, Genesis 15. Well, let's read that actually. Genesis 15, verse 3 to 6. Then Abraham said, "Look, you've given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, 'This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir.' Then he brought him outside and said, 'Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to number them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your descendants be.' And he believed in the Lord and he counted it to him for righteousness." Abraham understood that this word given to him, that from his seed the nations would be blessed, that it meant this promise of life. That was the promise to Abraham, that there would be this promise of life, that God would bring about a great nation, a people, and through that nation would come again, as Paul says in Galatians, that seed, singular, Jesus Christ would come, who would be the great life giver and save all people. Abraham understood that through him, God would fulfill his ultimate promise of saving the world. And Abraham now believed, and catch this, I love this, it was accounted to him as righteousness. Abraham didn't wait and see, okay, God, that's awesome, that's so cool, wonderful, just going to wait and see how this all plays out. No, he believed. He had faith in that. He knew, God, you're going to do something great here. I don't need to doubt that. I don't need to question it. And he believed, and it was now counted to him as righteousness. Now, this promise would all come about in a way they would least expect. Look at verse 6 here. But God spoke in this way, that his descendants would dwell in a foreign land, and that they would bring them into bondage and oppress them 400 years. And the nation to whom they will be in bondage, I will judge, said God. And after that, they shall come out and serve me in this place. It's not a very, you know, perhaps in Abraham's mind, a very good way of seeing this promise come to fruition. Can you imagine God, you know, just saying, I'm going to make you into a mighty nation, but first of all, I'm going to lead you into another nation so that they can oppress you, persecute you for 400 years. You'd be then, what? Wait a second. Hey, what's plan B? What's the contingency plan here, Lord? Let me hear that first, because this plan sounds a little bit odd. You're going to make us into a great nation, but first you're going to lead us into a foreign nation to oppress us for 400 years? It sounds like we're just going to be wiped out. How are you going to do anything from that, God? This is what God says to him. But God does all things well, and he has a purpose for everything. We have to truly realize that and grasp that, that all that God does is good. Even when it doesn't make sense to us, right? All that God does is good. This would be a time where Israel would be able to grow into a great and prosperous and strong nation, because they're going to be brought into Egypt, a nation that really just would look down upon the Hebrew people, these shepherding people that they thought was just an unclean practice. So the Egyptians would want no kind of dealings with the Hebrews. They'd want nothing to do with them. So the Hebrews would be able to just kind of live in isolation and grow up now in Egypt in this kind of protective womb that God's given them, so that they would be free from any kind of idolatry and carnality and that sort of a thing, and just grow as a nation. This is God's plan. It's perfect. I'm not going to leave you in Canaan, the land that's got, you know, it's full of pagan practice. I'm not going to leave you this land so that you can become, you know, subjected to these things. I know how, you know, vulnerable you can be to these things. He's not going to leave them in Canaan. He's going to bring them to another place where they're going to be able to grow in health and strength. Plus, I mean, this is amazing too, that in doing so, God leads his people into Egypt, and he's giving the people of Canaan 400 years to repent and to get right with the Lord. This is what he told Abraham. I'm going to give them an opportunity to repent. It's a great example for us to see that God sometimes brings us through times of difficulty, but so as to lead us on to further blessing. They're going to be brought into a land and they're going to undergo some difficulty. And we're going to read about that coming up here. But it's all for God's ultimate purpose of leading them on to further blessing. God does all things well. We don't need to question that. We've seen that happen in our recent history with things like the Holocaust, where God allowed such an atrocity to happen, but to bring about an even greater good, allowing Israel to be formed, you know, again into a nation and to be brought back into the land. And God's doing a great thing even here today in Israel. God does all things well. So God has it all planned out. And when Egypt now began to feel, you know, uneasy about Israel, then he says here that I will judge them and lead my people out of the land of Egypt and into the land that I have for them. The nation, verse 7, to whom they will be in bondage, I will judge, said God. And after that, then they shall come out and serve me in this place. His people, Israel, will come out and serve me in this place, in the land of Israel that Stephen is speaking from right now. By the way, Genesis 15:13 refers to a 400-year period, and Exodus 12:40 refers to a 430-year period. Now, rabbis reckoned that the 400 years from the birth was from the birth of Isaac to the Exodus, whereas some reckoned from God's promise to Abraham to the Exodus would make about 430 years. So it's just kind of a different way. When you see these things in the Bible, we're going to talk a little bit more here about some discrepancies that people apparently have with God's word that we'll see come up in chapter 7. Contradictions that people claim there are. It's just a different way of counting, basically, is all that we see here. You either take it from this day to this day, or you go from this day to this day. So it's 400 or it's 430, whatever way you're looking at it as. There's no contradiction ultimately here. But look at verse 8. Then he gave them the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot the 12 patriarchs. So Abraham was just blessed abundantly here. He was saved by grace, and it was accounted to him as righteous. And all that came, all this came before circumcision, it came before the law, it came before the temple. None of those things then were requirements for a right relationship with God. Again, that's what Stephen is trying to show them. None of these things were requirements for God blessing his people. It wasn't because of circumcision, it wasn't because of the law, because of the temple, because Abraham was accounted as righteous before all of those things. Remember the context. Stephen is being blamed for speaking against the law, speaking against the temple and against God. But Stephen is showing that God is bigger than those things and is not confined to those things. Over the years, the fulfilling of ritual had just taken the place of the enjoyment of reality. People were just so caught up in just going to the temple, doing our religious practice, doing all these things. And it kept them from really just enjoying the fullness of who God was and the reality of a relationship with him. It became just all external. Their hearts were far from God. So Stephen's directing them back to the reality that people had of just a closeness with God, not because of religious ritual, but just because of the grace of God. Abraham was a great example that salvation and righteousness was not about works, but it was all about faith through God's grace. Abraham's a great example of that. So we move from the life of Abraham, and we begin to look now at the patriarchs in Egypt. Look at verse 9 here. And the patriarchs, becoming envious, sold Joseph into Egypt. But God was with him and delivered him out of all his troubles and gave him favor and wisdom in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he made him governor over Egypt and all his house. Now, notice those words there. But God was with him. You see, just as God was with Abraham outside of Israel, so too God would be with Joseph outside of Israel. Again, that was the important truth that Stephen was looking to communicate with the Sanhedrin. God's not confined to a location. Joseph and others did not need to be at the temple to be close to God. There wasn't even a temple this time. There wasn't even the tabernacle at this time. Joseph did not need to be at a specific building or house of God to be close with God, because Stephen says God was with him. God was with him. wherever he was. And God was there to deliver him out of all his troubles. And Joseph's life, that was a life full of trouble, wasn't it? I mean, this guy went through the ringer, didn't he? Joseph went through some real difficulty. In fact, Joseph's life was brought up as an example because he's one of the clearest and purest types or pictures of Christ in the Old Testament. We're going to look at a lot of those different types of Joseph and how he is a picture of Jesus Christ. We'll look at that in a few minutes here. But here's Stephen now, and he's bringing up the life of Joseph here. Perhaps Stephen's audience was beginning to get a little bit uncomfortable as they began to hear about Joseph and be reminded of the way that he was treated. This was a great man of God, and yet it was his brothers, his own family, that mistreated him and rejected him. Perhaps they're getting a little bit uncomfortable seeing this in comparison to the way that they had treated Jesus. Again, this is Stephen's whole point now in doing so. Stephen skips over the details quickly here, but Joseph really endured some difficulties. He was hated by his brothers. Some of you can say amen to that. Boy, But he was sold for 20 pieces of silver, sold on the slave market in Egypt, falsely accused of assault by Potiphar's wife. He was sent to prison, forgotten by the butler who was released from prison. And you think you have a bad day every once in a while. Think about Joseph here, right? I mean, this guy, like I say, he went through the ringer. But as verse 9 says, again, God was what? With him. Say it loud so I can hear you. God was with him. Oh, isn't that good to know? God was with him even through all of that. Is that true for you today, guys? Is that true for you today? It doesn't matter how big your problems may be today. If God is with you, then you have one that is bigger than all your problems, who's working out all things according to his plans and his purposes. You know, we begin to freak out. We begin to worry and fret because we look at the circumstances around us. When God's simply looking at the big picture, he's seeing how everything is fitting together. He's seeing, yeah, you know what? Here's maybe a moment, a time in your life where the fire's getting turned up a little bit, but it's refining, it's bringing you through. And if you could only see what's awaiting you, it's going to be great. God sees the whole picture. We just see what's right in front of us. And we have to get above those circumstances and get that aerial view like God has and say and see and recognize that God's working it all out. God's doing a work through all of that. If we could get a glimpse, even by faith, that he's working it all out for the good, then we'd be a lot more at peace in the midst of the storm, wouldn't we? We have to be reminded of that at times. Because, you know, when we get our eyes on those difficulties, on those trials, on those hardships, man, it can really rob us of our faith. It blinds us to really be able to trust in God. But if we can rise above that and by faith say, God, you're bigger than this. You're handling it. Because, God, you're with me, even in the midst of this. I don't need to doubt that. I don't need to wonder what you're doing or where you are because, God, you're with me right now, right here, and you're leading me through. And if we can come to that realization by faith, it's going to allow us to have a lot more peace in the midst of our storms that we go through. Romans 8:28 sure is a verse that speaks right into the situation of Joseph. Romans 8:28, we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purposes. And Joseph, man, that verse could have been written solely for Joseph. I'm thankful that it's written for us all, but Joseph lived that out. All things were working together for the good. I mean, one thing after another, Joseph experienced. It's trial, it's hardship, it's all these things, and yet, boom, he ends up in this situation, God uses it. And also he ends up in this situation, again, it seems like a setback, but wait, God's using it. Then he ends up in this situation, it's a setback again. I'm in prison. Oh, I'm going to use you here. You're gonna do a work with these two guys. One of them is going to be released, and he's going to eventually remember you, which is going to lead you back up into being, you know, the guy in command over Egypt. I mean, God's doing a great thing, working all things out for the good. And you'll do that in our lives too. And we need to just hold on by faith and trust that he is working it all out for the good. That he's with us. We don't need to fear or worry. or fret over those things, but by faith, just keep leaning on him. Now look at verse 11. Now a famine and great trouble came over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and our fathers found no sustenance. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. So again, a famine comes, and notice that a great trouble. But here's a great trouble that God once more is using, right? I'd say it might seem like a great trouble to you, but it's my means to lead my people into Egypt, to be reunited with Joseph, who just so happens to be second in command. You're going to be in pretty good hands, right? God's working it all out. So famine hits, but again, God's using that to fulfill his purposes. He's wanting to get his people down to Egypt, and he had just simply sent Joseph on ahead and just prepared the way through Joseph. And Joseph was able to see all that too, didn't he? I mean, at the end of his life, at the end of Genesis, chapter 50, verse 20, Joseph says, "But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive." What a great witness. What a great example it is. Joseph says, you know what? You meant all these things for evil. And certainly his brothers, they had evil intent, right? They weren't necessarily acting according to God's heart here, but God used it. Joseph ends up being sold as a slave, ends up in a foreign country. And yet he's able to look back on all this and go, oh man, those were good times, right? No, probably not good times, but he's able to look back on it and go, boy, those were crazy days, huh, guys, you know? But hey, his brothers are sitting there trembling, you know? Like, this is it. This is the time he's going to kill us. He's going to knock us off, man. We deserve it too, man. Oh no, we're dead, you know? And I mean, they're fearing. But Joseph just says, hey guys, you know what? Forget about it, man. You meant it for evil, but guess what? There's somebody working that's greater than you, that's higher than you, that's above you. And he meant it for good. God turned it all around for good. Praise the Lord that God's able to do that. In your life, whatever situation you have going on that you think, man, there's just evil abounding. How is this ever going to turn around? Just know that God's able to take all that. And he's able to turn around and do good from it. Do you believe that tonight? I sure do. He's able to do that. I'm thankful for that. Great perspective to have on things. No matter what happens, God is able to bring it around for good. You know, I'm going to share with you guys, and I don't know if I should or not, permission to do so, but I trust this guy will be okay with it. But, you know, I was visiting with, some of you know Brent Mills, and he did some work in our building here. He'd come to a number of our studies, come to the church here, and great Christian brother. Well, he's got cancer right now, and he's got a tumor right in the esophagus. He's in the hospital, and he's not able to swallow anything. He's not able to eat anything. And he's sitting here just rejoicing in God that he's having opportunity to witness to many people and pray with people. Just a girl in his own room, you know, who was battling with a cancer and had lost feeling in her arm and was paralyzed. And he just was praying with her, and her parents were there, and she's begun to get feeling back in her arm, and has opened the door, opened her heart to hear the gospel, and for her parents even to be open to that. And he's walking around the hospital, and he's just ministering to people. And he's just sitting there going, wow, this is just incredible. God's really opened the door here. I'm sitting here going, you can't eat anything, you can't swallow, you got cancer, the outlook is not positive from what the doctors are saying, and you're sitting here just going, praise God, God's doing a work. That's amazing. And I've just been telling, man, you are just an inspiration. It's incredible. Keep praying for them. There's others in our church that are going through struggles, and let's keep praying for them that God will use them even through all of those things, and what a blessing that is. And so in verse 13, the second time, now Joseph was made known to his brothers, and Joseph's family became known to the Pharaoh. And that's an important point that Stephen is making here. The second time that his brothers are brought before him, that they now recognize and see who Joseph truly is. Because his audience, they had a habit now of rejecting those men that God chose to use. Their own fathers had turned on Joseph and rejected him. They're seeing that clearly through just the accounting of Joseph's life. They're seeing, man, those are our own fathers, right? Our own people that rejected him. And again, Joseph is one of the great types or pictures of Jesus. And as his brothers are brought in now, the second time it's when they recognize him and see him. Let's look at some of these types and pictures of Jesus. If you've never seen these before, I'm sure a lot of you have, and that's great. We'll review them. But for those of you that haven't seen them before, notice this. Joseph, he was a shepherd. It wasn't Jesus our great shepherd. Joseph was loved by his father. Certainly Jesus was too. He was sent unto his brethren. He was obedient to his father. Joseph was hated by his brothers. Jesus too. He prophesied of his coming glory. Remember, he shared the dream. That's what got him in trouble. He shared the dream of what was going to come. And didn't go over too well. But Jesus prophesied of his coming glory as well. Many people did not believe him. Joseph was rejected by his brothers. He endured unjust punishment from his brothers. He was sentenced to the pit, delivered to the pit through a leader, though a leader knew he should go free. Remember, one of his brothers was trying to stand up for him and didn't really go all the way. And same with Jesus. There was a leader that knew he should go free, Pilate. Joseph was sold for pieces of silver, and then he was handed over to the Gentiles. We'll move on here. He was regarded as dead, but raised out of the pit. He went to Egypt, made a servant. He was tempted severely, but did not sin. He was falsely accused, made no defense, cast into prison and numbered with sinners and criminals, endures unjust punishment from Gentiles, associated with two other criminals. One is pardoned and one is not. That's interesting, isn't it? Joseph, they're in the prison. And remember, one of them would be set free, the other would not. Jesus on the cross, two criminals. One is entering into paradise on that day and the other is not. Joseph showed compassion. He brings a message of deliverance even there in prison. He wanted to be remembered, shown to have divine wisdom. Joseph was recognized as having the Spirit of God. He was betrayed by friends, glorified after his humility, honored among Gentiles while still despised or forgotten by his brethren. Given a Gentile bride, 30 years old when he began his life's work. He blesses the world with bread. He was the only source of bread. The world is instructed to go to him and do whatever he says to do. And he's recognized the second time he goes before his brethren. That's what I want to look at here. That's what we're dealing with here in verse 13. Just as what took place with Joseph, his brothers rejected him. They were brought before him. Did not recognize him. Did not know who he really was. Until it was the second time that Joseph was revealed to them. And so too the Jews of this day had done the very same thing with Jesus. They didn't recognize when Jesus came the first time that he was truly God, their Messiah, their deliverer, the one that had come to save. They didn't believe it. They rejected him. And it's going to take them through a time of trouble and trial, which is going to lead them ultimately back to Jesus. The Jews are going to continue to go through a period of hardship all through the tribulation, which is ultimately going to lead them to a place where they are brought before Jesus again, where they will once more recognize him. And it'll be at his second coming. Zechariah chapter 12. We're going to be covering this in a few weeks. I can't wait to get to this chapter. Zechariah 12:10. And I'll pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn. And then as we move on to verse 14, then Joseph sent and called his father Jacob and all his relatives to him, 75 people. So Joseph went down to Egypt and he died, he and our fathers, and they were carried back to Shechem and laid in a tomb that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Again, like I was saying earlier, some people like to try to disprove the Bible by saying it's loaded with, you know, discrepancies, contradictions, errors, omissions, things like that. Oh, you can't trust the Bible. It's just, man, no way. It's all over the place. Now, these verses right here, verse 14 to 16, contain a couple argued contradictions. Now, Genesis 46, verse 27, and Exodus 1:5 says that there were 70 from Jacob's family that went down to Egypt. But Stephen, remember he was one of the Hellenistic Jews that were selected to be one of the early church, part of the team that would come and serve. Hellenistic Jew meant that he grew up under that Greek kind of culture. So Stephen is using the Septuagint. It's the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And in the Septuagint, the number 75 is used here. The Septuagint would have most likely included Joseph's sons and grandsons that he had there in Egypt and arrived at that number through that. It's not a contradiction, but again, just a different way of counting. One group says, well, we're going to count just Jacob and his children and all their children that left from Israel to go to Egypt. Another group says, we're going to include the people of Jacob's family that are with Joseph in Egypt. It's just a different way of counting. It's not a contradiction. It's just saying, we're going to include these people. The other people say, we're not going to include them. No contradiction at all. Another seeming contradiction is found with the tomb that Abraham bought from the sons of Hamor. Yet Moses says in writing that Jacob bought it. Genesis 23, verse 16 to 17 says that Abraham bought the cave of Machpelah in Hebron from the sons of Heth, and Jacob bought land in Shechem from the children of Hamor, as Genesis 33, verse 19 tells us. Now, there are several possibilities for this. First of all, Abraham may have bought land in Shechem as well as in Hebron, and later Jacob could have repurchased the plot in Shechem. It's very possible that over time the Canaanites had just kind of overtaken that plot and it wasn't being used, and so they just overtook it, that Jacob had to come and repurchase it again. That's a very likely scenario. Stephen could have used Abraham's name for Abraham's descendant and mentioned Abraham, which really referred to Jacob, but a lot of times, again, they would refer to a former ancestor as encompassing all of that. Stephen may have thoroughly condensed the purchase by Abraham and Jacob into just one for brevity. So it could be that they both had a part to play, and there's a lot of different ideas here. But again, there's a certain conclusion that there's no error, there's no contradiction here, all right? Now, in Stephen's day, Shechem was in Samaritan territory, okay? We all know the history of the Samaritans with the Jews, or maybe you do, maybe you don't, but the Jews didn't want anything to do with the Samaritans. They saw them as kind of a mixed race, a half-breed. They were an impure people. And so Jews wanted nothing to do with Samaritans. If they were traveling up north and the logical, the most direct route was through Samaria, they wouldn't take it. They'd say, we're not even setting foot in Samaria. We're going to go around. We're going to take a long route just so that we can avoid being in Samaria. They did not like Samaritans, and the Samaritans didn't care for the Jews a whole lot either. It was certainly with that kind of attitude towards them. So he reminded the Sanhedrin that their ancestral deliverer was buried in the land that Orthodox Jews despised and avoided. Their very ancestor, a guy they highly revered, was buried right there in that land. It was another instance of helping them see that they should not think that the only place that God worked was right there in the promised land. Stephen had already referred to Mesopotamia as where God had revealed himself to Abraham, Joseph being down in Egypt and there doing a good work. It's another instance just to show his audience here that God is not subjected or reserved only to one certain location, but God is doing a work all over. So the only thing that Abraham owned, interestingly, was the tomb. Remember, we saw earlier that he wouldn't possess any part of the land, not even one foot step that he set in the land, he wouldn't occupy that. The only thing that he owned was the tomb. Our real investment should be in that which enables us to lay our life down, right? That's what we should be investing in. If it's something that enables us to be able to lay our life down more for the Lord so that we can live in him, boy, that's something that we need to be invested in. Well, next we come to another popular figure in Israel's history that went through a period of rejection, even though he was God's chosen instrument for deliverance, and that's the life of Moses. So let's look at Moses here for a bit. Verse 17. But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dealt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so that they might not live. Notice that everything was working according to God's great timetable here, because we read there in verse 17 that when the time of the promise drew near, God is seeing exactly when the right time is to have things unfold, right? He's working according to his divine timetable. He's bringing all things together at just the right time. We can take great comfort in that. That God is carrying out all that he desires to do at just the right time. And he's seeing it all coming ahead. At the time that the promise began to draw near, he sees it coming. Moses, others are sitting there going, when is this going to happen? We don't know. God's looking at, and he's seeing everything, you know. Seeing everything, and he's going, yeah, just a little bit here. Just about there. It's coming. And he's beginning to, again, to set his plans in motion here. And to accomplish his desires, there would be some, again, hardship along the way. It's the same things that we experience at times. God uses difficult trials to do a greater work. We saw that with Abraham, with Joseph already here tonight, now with Moses. Going to carry out even times of hardship and difficult trials to do a greater work. And so we don't need to fear. Again, trials doesn't mean that you're walking in disobedience or sin, right? Don't let anybody tell you that. Oh man, you're really going through the ringer here. What have you done? What's the matter with you? You better get right with God. You ever hear people say that? Man, that's not the case. God brings his people through difficulty and trial at times to refine us, but at times to again do his greater work to lead us on into further blessing. And so we read there in verse 18 that a new king came into power, a new Pharaoh over Egypt. And he's a guy that saw how the Hebrew people were being blessed, and they were growing, they were multiplying, they were becoming very numerous. And this new Pharaoh thought, we got to do something about this, because these people, as they get stronger and greater, maybe they're going to come against us. Maybe they're going to try to overtake us. So that we got to do something. And so this Pharaoh thought, let's oppress them. Let's bring them into slavery. Let's just beat them down. So that they just become too weak to even think about doing anything like that. It's believed at this time in Egypt that there were about 2 million Jews. So again, it's a great work that God had done, wasn't it? Taking 70 people in Egypt. And over definitely a number of years, but growing them into a mighty nation now. Right? And so not only does Pharaoh think, let's put them into slavery and oppression, but let's now take out their male babies that come. Let's not let them grow anymore. Let's not let them reproduce any longer. And so they take out the male babies. Give an edict for all male Hebrew babies to be killed, thrown into the river. And that brings us to Moses now. And at this time, verse 20, Moses was born and was well pleased in God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. So Moses' parents, they took their child and placed him in a basket and put him in the Nile River. Interestingly, they followed the king's command without having to break God's command. They put him in the river, just like, you know, Pharaoh said, all those Hebrew baby boys, place them in the river. All right, we'll do so. We'll just put them in a basket in the river. So, again, didn't break the king's command, and neither did they have to break God's command here. Now, it took a lot of faith from Moses' parents, didn't it? They took a real step of faith here because they had to let Moses go and really trust the Lord to take care of him here. I mean, really just leaving it all in the Lord's hands. But look at how God has this all worked out. At just the time that they place him in the river, Pharaoh's daughter comes down to the river to bathe. And just as she's about to bathe, she sees him there, you know, on the river banks. And she's filled with compassion, filled with a heart of love for this young baby boy that she sees there. Isn't that great? I mean, God has this so wonderfully worked out. As we saw earlier, that as the promise drew near, God was seeing all these things coming together. And now he knows exactly how things need to play out here. He's got everything. I mean, it's not coincidence. It's not just sitting there where you go, oh man, that's so, whoo, boy, his parents are sure lucky. Whoo, that was a good time. Glad they didn't come, you know, half an hour later or half an hour earlier. Boy, they sure planned. Boy, they were lucky on that one. No, this is God's working everything out for the good, right? So they come down. And I mean, just God's so awesome. She, the daughter of Pharaoh, has compassion on Moses, brings him in as her own to where Moses now is able to grow up in the luxuries of the palace of the king now in Egypt. How awesome is God? And not only that, but Moses' mother, remember Moses' mom has her daughter, Moses' sister, watching to see what's going to happen. And so she's watching, and as she sees Pharaoh's daughter grab the baby, she approaches her. Oh, that looks like one of the Hebrew boys. Should I grab one of the Hebrew ladies to come and help you with him? Yes, go again. So she goes against Moses' mom, brings her in. Pharaoh's daughter says, listen, will you nurse this child here? And I'll give you your wages for it. I mean, how awesome is that? That Moses' mom lets him go, trust the Lord here, and now she's reunited with her child, and she's getting paid for it. How cool is that? Isn't God good? This is awesome stuff. You can't script this better than that. I mean, you can't write this better. God just got this all worked out so wonderfully well. It's just far out here. So Moses grows. Pharaoh's daughter takes him as her own, and he grows up to be well-educated, it says, in all wisdom of the Egyptians. That would include, you know, science and math, astronomy and medicine. Furthermore, it would be the best knowledge available because he was trained in the palace of Pharaoh. So Moses, man, he's a well-educated guy. It's a guy of just privilege here. And he's mighty in words and deeds as well. The fact that Moses was an excellent speaker is not necessarily in conflict with how he would later declare that he was not able to speak well. Remember, that's one of the excuses he gives to God. God, don't send me. I can't speak, man. My tongue is blah, blah, blah. I'm just not going to get anything out. I'm not the spokesman you need. It could be that here was Moses growing up. He was mighty in words and deeds. But then remember, Moses had to go through a lot, right? He gets kind of taken to the school of hard knocks. He gets kind of, you know, goes through 40 years as a shepherd. I mean, just intense changes taking place in his life. Just growing in humility. And he may have lost that boldness through these experiences he went through, to where he just really came to a place of just real humility. Didn't have that boldness any longer to speak. He says, no, Lord, I can't do that. But we know the Lord would use him anyways. And the mighty deeds would refer to military successes. I mean, Moses probably was well-trained, again, in any kind of combat, military stuff. We're going to see what he does here in a minute. And probably just, you know, using some great military strategic ninja moves on this guy. But look at here, verse 23. Now, when he was 40 years old, it came in his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand. But they did not understand. And the next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting and tried to reconcile them, saying, men, you are brethren. Why do you wrong one another? But he who did his neighbor wrong pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday? Then at this saying, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons. Now, as Moses grows up in the palace, he knows who he is. All right? He knows he's a Hebrew. And he would most likely have known about the promises of God in regard to God desiring to bring his people out of Egypt and lead them into his promised land for them. It's most likely that Moses understood all these things. He's well educated and he knows what's going on. He knows he's a Hebrew. And to have his people, the Hebrews, come out of Egypt, it's going to require someone to lead them, to be a deliverer. Perhaps Moses is retracing now his own life and going, wait a second, man. I've gone through some pretty miraculous survival, you know, as a baby. I've had some distinct and special upbringing. I must be the guy that God's got set apart. I'm a Hebrew person. I brought up in Pharaoh's house. I must be the guy that God wants to use to bring his people out of Egypt. And so Moses goes out, you know. He's thinking, I'm the guy, right? I must be the guy. Gets his cape on, puts his tights on. He steps out and he's like, I'm the hero, guys. I'm the one, right? And he goes to his brethren, it says. He goes to his people now. And he begins to see what's going on. And this is 40 years after the fact. Now, he's 40 years old this time. And it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. So he's got this desire, this calling now, right? So here he comes now, their potential hero onto the scene. First up, he comes to an Egyptian and a Jew. The Egyptian is beating the Hebrew. Now, of course, that doesn't sit well with this new mass crusader, this hero now that's coming onto the scene, right? So it tells us in Exodus chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, or sorry, Exodus 2, verse 12, that Moses, this is interesting, you know, Moses comes up to these two guys, right? Remember, he's mighty in deeds, military kind of advancement. This guy's strong, right? He's well trained, okay? And Exodus 2:12 tells us that Moses looked this way. He looked that way. You ever do that, you know? Kind of going, anybody going to see what I'm about to do here? You know, and Moses looks over. He just takes an Egyptian, just like, you know, whoosh, does a couple moves, drops the guy. He's dead, right? You know, that's it. And he buries him in the sand just to cover it all up. And this is Moses' action now in dealing with all this here. This is his way of coming on the scene and saying, I must be the guy. I'm coming to do the work now that God must be desiring for me. Well, next up, he comes to two Jews. And they're having a bit of a tiff here now. Moses, once again, steps in to break it up, and his desire is to help reconcile them. But the one doesn't want his help and begins to taunt him. Moses is shocked that they know about what he had just done earlier in killing that Egyptian. Remember, the guy says, what are you going to do? You're going to kill me like you did the Egyptian? You see, Moses was a guy that tried to cover up his sin, but we can be sure, as the word tells us, that our sin will find us out. Moses had looked that way. He looked that way, but he didn't look this way. He didn't look up. He didn't look to see that, wait a second. God is seeing all. I need to look to the Lord first, because nothing is hid from his sight. And it's important that we look to God for what he wants us to do. Because again now, Moses thought that he must be the guy, the deliverer. And though that was true, he went about it the wrong way. He moved forward in his own strength and wisdom. He went in the power of the flesh, didn't he? Says, here I am, guys. Oh, Egyptian, Jew, Egyptian beating the Jew. Not in my day, you know. And he just knocks the guy down, kills him. Sees two Jews having a bit of an issue. He steps in, is like, hey, guys, it's me. You know, the leader, the deliverer, right? You see my cape, my tights, I'm the guy, right? Just, you got to respect me here, right? He's coming in, but he's doing it all in his own power. He's not heard God say, all right, Moses, here's what I got for you. He's stepping in to be the guy to solve all the problems now. Operating in the power of the flesh when he should have been powered by the Spirit of God. And so God leads Moses on to a period in his life where he's going to undergo this training and preparation time. Remember that as the Jew says to him, what are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian? Moses, it says, flees to Midian. It tells us that right there in verse 29. Became a dweller in the land of Midian. And it's going to be a period now that God is going to take Moses to prepare him for the work that God does have for him. It's true, God did desire Moses to be the guy, that he did place Moses in that situation to be the guy. But Moses had to be a guy that says, Lord, I'm going to move as you show me. I'm going to follow you. I'm going to be led by you. I'm going to be powered by you, not by my own might. Not by my own ability, not by my own desires. So Moses now is brought out to Midian, time of training and preparation. He's going to move out to the desert hills of Midian where he's going to learn to tend the flocks of Jethro, his father-in-law. Great training time to shepherd the flocks there that Jethro has before he can come onto the scene to shepherd a nation. See, God's going to oftentimes take us through the desert, but there are times of training and preparation. It's time to learn dependency on the Lord. He did that with Paul. When Paul got saved, he led him out into the Arabian desert. And it was a time where Paul was to be trained up, prepared for all that God was going to have for him. Paul didn't just step into the action, into the scene and go, all right, man, I just had a great experience on the road to Damascus. Well, you guys got to listen to me now. I just heard from the Lord. He doesn't step in and start, you know, taking over. He says, wait, man, time of training and preparation. God's going to bring his people oftentimes through the desert to prepare them and train them for all that he has for them. It's time to learn dependency on the Lord and faithfulness in the little things so that God can move you into bigger things. That's what this time was for Moses. And we'll see him go through this period for 40 years. 40 years he's going to be just there, shepherding the flock and Jethro, and just being in this place of preparation and training. You know, God is never in as big of a hurry as we are to accomplish his work. You ever found that to be true? We tend to want to rush things. We live in a world where everything's fast-paced. We want to just make things happen. Oh, we got to move. We got to make this happen. We got to do this. And God said, well, hey, just chill, man. Sit back a bit. Like, I've got this. I'll get it done. I mean, we got this covered here. But there's a work that I'm going to do in you and with you before I do a work through you here in this situation. He's doing that with Moses. We must be careful to do God's work in God's way, in God's time, and for God's reasons. Okay? We have to be careful. Moses failed in this here. We have to be careful that we do God's work in God's way and in God's time and for God's reasons. It's been said that Moses spent 40 years thinking he was somebody, then spent 40 years finding out he was nobody. Finally, he spent 40 years finding out what God could do with somebody who was nobody. Very true. And those were the three kind of stages in his life. 40 years, he grows up. Then for 40 years, he's out, kind of getting ready for what God has. Then for another 40 years, God is using him to lead his people out of Egypt and through the wilderness. And in verse 30, we should really just wrap it up right there. Let's do that. Let's wrap it up right there. And we'll pick it up next week in verse 30, and we'll finish the chapter. Great chapter, long chapter, but a great chapter, isn't it? Just looking at the history, isn't it great to just go back, look back in the past and learn from some of these great examples and the applications it has for us? So we're going to continue to look at Moses and the things that God did through Moses and see how Stephen is guiding and directing this whole message, this whole sermon that he's giving here to really open up the eyes of the people. We know that the audience here, we know the outcome. They're just going to continue to follow the example of their forefathers who rejected everything that God was really ultimately doing and how he was leading. But Stephen is just laying out the truth for them here. Well, let's just go to the Lord in prayer here right now, and we'll wrap it up.